World Council of Indigenous People will be here later on today. Raina Green of the Native American Program at the Smithsonian will be here later today. And Bernard Nietschmann,
in my opinion, a defender of the basic rights of the Indians, he was also used for propaganda purposes. And the struggle goes on. Even Spaniards themselves today are not sure whether he's a glory of Spain or somebody who should be forgotten and opposed. Some of the sharpest arguments against Las Casas have been written by Spaniards. And the Dominican Order has never really done very much for him either. I was surprised in January of this year to find the Dominican Order. In fact, the head honcho himself from Rome went to Berkeley to announce at a two-day meeting on Las Casas lives today, the Master General of the Dominican Order, an Irishman, announced that they were seeking beatification and canonization for Las Casas. This is the first time that the Dominican Order itself has done very much for Las Casas. And Spaniards, as late as 1962, the greatest then living Spanish man of letters, Ramon Menendez Pidal, wrote a book denouncing Las Casas as a paranoid. I remember I was quite surprised and pleased in 1958 when we first met, Don Ramon and I met in Cologne at a celebration in honor of Emperor Charles V. He called me, "Oh, Hanky, un Las Casista tolerable." I don't know whether he would consider me tolerable after he read the long article I wrote analyzing his views, which was entitled More Heat and Some Light on the Spanish Conquest of America. Be that as it may, Don Ramon was the greatest authority in Spain. And his attack, in most respects, was the most sophisticated, the most documented attack on Las Casas, 1962. So I was surprised that the Dominican Order put him up for beatification and canonization, and Spain itself. In February, just last month, I was happy to be present in Madrid at a meeting organized by the cultural section of the present socialist government. They too wanted to honor Las Casas. However, I noticed they didn't permit any Dominican to speak. In Mexico, in October, where they had another meeting, they did have a Dominican speak, but not in Spain. However, it goes on. They recognize Las Casas, although the story has not been ended. I still remember in 1932 when I went to Spain to work on Las Casas, my good friend Earl J. Hamilton, a great economic historian who wrote a classic work on the effect of the Spanish conquest on the rise of prices in Europe. He said, "Hanky, what are you doing working on Las Casas? When are you going to work on some important topic?" Well, I was shaken a little bit, and I wrote to Ludwig Fandel, the great German scholar in the Golden Age studies. He wrote back also and said, "Well, we know all we need to know about Las Casas. All his publications have been known. Why bother?" And then I wrote to Emilio Ravignani, the Argentine, who had brought out a few years before a facsimile edition of his 1552 treatises. And Ravignani said, "No, we all have a superficial knowledge of Las Casas, but his truth, his basic ideas have not yet been fully understood." He encouraged me. I wanted that. I followed that address, which of course that advice, which I supported, and that began my interest until today. I still think it's a good topic for discussion, and I believe that the Spaniards will be useful as a historical background. I was trying to think whether there's any Spanish background for this present discussion. I don't think there is. I believe that the Alaska Native Review Commission is making history. And I'm glad to hear that the documentation of these proceedings, these many discussions in the field, these various roundtables are going to be preserved at the University of Alaska, so they'll be useful for scholars in the future. Because this struggle has been long, it has not ended. And perhaps in 1992, right after that famous 1991 date, which has been mentioned, in 1992, when the world will be studying the first 500 years of the discovery of America, all kinds of curious things will be done. I think there are many government commissions already set up, and I imagine there are going to be many banquets, medals struck off, political figures can go by first class air to various meetings to discuss well-known subjects. But I hope that in 1992, one of the important, one of the basic topics will be the history of the native peoples of the Americas, from Alaska to Patagonia. And I'm sure that the proceedings of Judge Berger's activities will be one of the important, indeed indispensable parts of that record. I thought just of one possible predecessor, not really, but it should be mentioned. In the early 16th century in the Caribbean, there was some Spanish government official with a sociological orientation who decided to determine whether the Indians could learn to live like there must be some kind of what I call a delicate balance.
David Case and then Bishop DeRue.
Two words that you said piqued my curiosity in this question. I think it goes to something that Hugh Brody was touching on, only from another angle. To what extent, I wonder, does Las Casas's view of rights and his ideals presume that by the phrase you use, peaceful persuasion, the native American cultures would in fact be changed and thereby developed and eventually assimilated into what perhaps even Las Casas viewed as a better culture? Is that also part of, or consistent with Las Casas's views on the rights of the Indies?
I don't think he used the phrase better culture. I do know that when someone charged him with supporting a doctrine that should not be supported, namely peaceful preaching alone, when some Spanish, I think Dominicans, were killed by Indians in Florida in the 16th century, they said, look, this is what happens. Peaceful preaching, your brothers are killed. Is that what you support? And his answer was yes. I don't know whether he said that the blood of martyrs is something which produces Christians, I don't know. But he did support that.
But was the point of it that that was just a better way, morally and ethically, to change the original culture?
No, he said something which has not been emphasized by Las Casistas scholars, which is this. He said, if it is necessary to use force to Christianize the Indians. He didn't accept that, but he said if by chance it should, some people thought that, he would rather that the Indians were left unchristianized than be forced to accept Christianity. That is a, I don't know what his Dominican brothers would have thought about that, but he said that. And I think we're faced here with a man of many facets, a man who was a political batter all his life. He didn't have one position always. For a while, he used Indians as servants. He exploited them. He heard Montesinos, but he wasn't convinced by Montesinos in 1511. Only gradually did he come around to this position. So that you have to be sure what period of his life you're talking about. It was not a monolithic structure. However, I don't think he, after his position was solidified and clarified, I don't think he ever went back on his basic thought, one, that all peoples of the world have a potentiality for education. That was fundamental to him. And two, that it was necessary to study other cultures. Even some other cultures were better than Spain. I remember in his great work, Apologetic Historia, the Apologetic History, he wrote that the women, Indian women, he thought had a much saner life, healthy life than the Spanish women because the Indian women worked with their own hands. That he thought was a very commendable thing. He also felt that some of the monuments of the Mayas, for example, the Chichen Itza and all those Maya great monuments, he said he thought that they were comparable to and at least as important as the pyramids of Egypt. This is an artistic archaeological judgment which has been confirmed by modern archaeologists. But those two pillars, I don't think he ever veered from following those two basic thoughts. No, I wouldn't support everything Las Casas said. He said something, he doubtless exaggerated some things. Ramon Menendez Pidal, chapter by chapter, rolled out where he thought Las Casas was wrong or exaggerated or something. But I think today, speaking about the problems which we have in the world today, it is they're fundamental. And remember also, we're in the 16th century and today, there were very few people who went to the New World, just as very few people came to Alaska under Russia. I think most of the 600 people in Alaska under Russia, 600 Russians, I mean. Cortez had just a small...
Men, equally with the white Americans, was also expressed officially. There's a message from President Madison to the chiefs of Indian tribes in which he details all the ways in which, in his opinion, the American Indians are the equals of the whites. And that message was a plea to the Indians to improve themselves. And what he said was, look, you are in no way inferior to us in intelligence, in skills, in physical abilities, in courage. And yet, the people who live in that same territory, the Americans, are well-fed, well-clothed, warm in the winter, and your people are hungry, sick, cold. And what's the difference? Not that you are in any way inferior, but we farm and you don't. And he offered to them to help them become farmers and learn agriculture in their own territory. Well, it didn't happen, and in all likelihood couldn't have happened. They were not, the Indians were not, in that area, we're not farming people. But my point here is that that the injustices that were occurring
And the displacement that was occurring was not based, the Indians were inferior and were not based on a lack of understanding of what justice required. That was stated clearly by, in official documents, repeatedly. Also, when the Indian chiefs spoke in meetings, it was clear that they had very impressive and eloquent statements of what the situation was and what justice required, and the statements were of such a nature that no one could have missed that these were people of equal ability and equal claims to all the characteristics of humanity. So I think that raises this question. First of all, in response to Hugh Brody's question, what is the force of principles of justice? Are they merely pieties and platitudes, or do they have some real influence over human events? I think the fact that those statements are made repeatedly in official documents, and that we come now trying to grapple with these problems, and that they keep coming up over and over again. What are the rights on one side and another? Shows that we cannot ignore these things, especially in a nation dedicated to the principles of liberty, equality, and justice. There is a nagging persistence that we must find a way to make our behavior accord with the principles, even though we know, as human beings, that there will be some difference between what we do and what we say and what we believe in. But that those statements of justice and those are not, they may be in the mouths of some scoundrels simply platitudes and deceptions, but that they have a force that cannot be ignored and that comes back persistently and influences what we are willing to do and what we try to do, I think is indisputable. The difficulty is that
maintained a degree of autonomy from the state through various accords and treaties with the Panamanian officials, and are probably the group in South America and perhaps in all of the Americas that today possesses more sovereignty in the true meaning of the term than perhaps any other indigenous group in the Americas right now, the Kuna of Panama, and also maintains a type of political organization and natural economy that's more related to their national system. The other example, which has been in the news, are the Miskito and the Sumo and the Rama of the eastern coast South America, of Nicaragua, the Miskito, Sumo, and Rama, that perhaps number about 120,000 people on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, that live in one of the most ecologically interesting areas in South America, because the rainforest comes right up to the ocean. And the people maintain an environmental adaptation which includes both maritime fishing and turtle hunting and the usage of inland rivers and inland animal resources as well as horticulture for subsistence. This area, like other areas of lowland South America, the east coast of Nicaragua, has been faced from the late 19th century, but increasingly after the Second World War, by enormous penetration by outside timber companies, mining companies, and colonization, such that from about 1965 onward, the percentage of people on the Atlantic coast was higher among non-indigenous or Spanish people than it was amongst indigenous people on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. Now, what's the problem of the highland Indians and the lowland ethnic enclaves? The problem is revolution. The problem is war and civil strife. At the current time throughout South America, throughout Central America, unlike the Andean region and unlike the lowland South American countries, they're in the midst of violent revolutions. Revolutions in the name, really, of agrarian reform and of rural and national social transformation, but that are carrying out with weapons of war that are part of the East-West struggle, the Soviet Union and Cuba and the United States, that are part of models of society that will impose radical transformations on the Central American countries, or will continue with repressive apparatuses, for example in Guatemala, to maintain much systems of control where there will be no parliamentary democracy, very little public participation. And it's that conflict, that uprooting, that turmoil, where indigenous people have been right in the middle of it. The case of Guatemala is perhaps the most serious, because in Guatemala, in the struggle between revolutionary movements and between the Guatemalan military, perhaps as many as 1 million people have been uprooted in Guatemala. 1 million indigenous people of a population of 4 million are displaced. At least 150,000 are in Mexico, 46,000 in camps either along the Chiapas border with Chiapas or in Campeche at present. 900,000 Indians in Guatemala have been organized by the Guatemalan military into civilian defense patrols without any voluntary choices. The government is planning to build 75 strategic hamlets, which they call model villages. Indigenous communities have been massacred in the scores. Thousands of indigenous people have disappeared, and their families don't know where they are. It's a situation in the Americas that could only be compared from the indigenous point of view to Cambodia. From the indigenous point of view. On the national level, it hasn't quite reached Cambodia, but on the indigenous level, it's comparable to the genocide that has taken place. And on the other side, we have Nicaragua, where as a result of an armed struggle and an armed revolution and a social transformation, in a new regime that was both nationalist and also socialist and Marxist in its orientation, an enormous conflict emerged between the ethnic rights of an ethnic federation, Misurisata, that developed after the Sandinista Revolution, and the Sandinista state. A conflict which led to the suppression of the indigenous organization, Misurisata, the jailing of its leadership in February of 1981, the escape of in the spring of February 81 of at least 3,000 Miskito to Honduras, the continued suppression of the indigenous organization in the summer of 1981, and armed conflict between indigenous people in both Honduras and within Nicaragua with the Sandinista Revolutionary Government from 1982 onward. In January of 1982, 8,500 Miskito from over 40 villages along the Rio Coco were relocated without any choice to an area outside of the border with Honduras, and another 12,000 Miskito went into Honduras as refugees. Currently, there's over 20,000 Miskito as refugees on the Honduran side of the border, numerous people living in relocation camps within Nicaragua, and an incredible degree of animosity that sometimes has moved toward some levels of negotiation between the state and the indigenous people, but then periodically there'll be an attempt at reconciliation and then a failure. Well, from the Alaska point of view, what's the relationship to the armed, the role of violence in relationship to the indigenous people? These will be my final comments. In that situation, I don't think there are some parallels if we want to move toward, in terms of indigenous land rights and cultural rights, the right to autonomy, but I think the major lesson from that situation is the potentiality of Native peoples that are outside of Central America to provide solidarity in terms of protecting and defending the human rights of the indigenous populations of Central America. The main, perhaps, relationship here, I think lesson to be learned, is the necessity at this point for an alliance between indigenous people with the indigenous people of Central America. The voice of indigenous people, the degree of human rights violation, is not known by the United States Congress. It's known, but it's not currently having much influence. There's a military and economic aid package of $68 million to the Guatemalan government at present, most of which is being allocated for projects in the Guatemalan highlands. The United States is providing the weapons of war in the Honduran, in the Nicaraguan conflict between the insurgents that are outside of Nicaragua and the Sandinista government, the weapons of war that are making it impossible for a reconciliation between, in part impossible for a reconciliation between the Nicaraguan government and the Miskito people in exile. And perhaps the influence that could be brought to make this a moral issue and eventually a political issue is by Native people joining in support of their brothers and sisters in Central America. The thing that essentially comes to mind is the role, for example, of Israel and the role that the American Jewish community has played in relation to Israel, or the role that the American Irish community has placed in relation to Ireland, or the role that the American Polish community has played in terms of United States policy toward Eastern Europe. The indigenous Native American people have not yet had a voice in North America in terms of foreign policy, and perhaps the issues around Central America, if brought by indigenous Native people, could have an influence on U.S. foreign policy that could then have consequences in Central America for the rights of those people. Well, I sort of, just to summarize, given three situations that are incredibly complex, but perhaps, you know, some level of discussion.
Well, thanks, Sandy. Just before we put questions to Sandy, let me welcome Oscar Coagley to the roundtable. Oscar Coagley is a member of the Executive Council of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and Director of Native Education in the Lower Kuskokwim School District here in Alaska. So we're glad you were able to make it, Oscar. Well, anybody want to question Sandy about some of these things that he's talked about?
My name is Bernard Nitschman.
Yes, welcome.
I didn't realize you'd arrived.
Wait for your name card.
Thank you. Hard to read.
Indigenous peoples don't want to change, that they are traditional, they don't want to change their way of life, and that it's unrealistic in today's modern world. Basically, the states say, look, we have a lot of mouths to feed, we have a lot of needs, so we're going to do these things, feed our people, and satisfy our needs by taking resources off your lands and taking your lands, because we control the power relationship that can justify doing this. Or we are the transnationals. Traditional and modern dichotomy is not very helpful for us here. It's just a substitution for old terms, barbarian and civilization. Indigenous peoples that I've worked with and for want to develop, but they want that development to be in their hands because those lands are theirs and those resources are theirs. And they have the capacity, often justified with centuries of sustainable use, at a ratio that no transnational has matched, that no national government has matched, in a comparative capacity to use resources sustainably. So they want very much to be in control of their own destiny and control of their own development, but also, as I think you so aptly pointed out, to share that knowledge to how resources can be used sustainably. It is no longer possible to justify invasions of other people's lands and theft of their resources by taking out again the tried old myth of population growth justifies anything. You're indigenous, therefore you're traditional, you don't want to change, and you need to be educated and brought into the 20th century. That won't work anymore. If development in indigenous peoples, development in a Western sense, is to have any mutual benefit, it will be indigenous peoples who are also developing the course, the context of resource use on a sustainable basis. And that's happening. World Conservation Strategy, IUCN, 1980. How to Save the World, another publication at the international level, all bring up, let's look at indigenous resource use. And you can't look at indigenous resource use if indigenous peoples don't have the land or the resources. That's library material. Thank you.
Doug, were you... Doug Sanders.
I was just a bit taken by a book titled How to Save the World. is it one volume? It seemed to me that there was a structure in your comment which was incorrect, which was dividing into certain societies as designating certain societies as growth societies and other societies as subsistence societies. This was all prompted by Rosita Worrell, who is from one of the most materialistic growth cultures I think that the world has ever produced. And if one says, well, all right, but the Northwest Coast was an absolutely peculiar phenomenon, in truth, it was not.
Up here, that's the Southeast.
I'm sorry. Yes, I can't geographically cope with that. That's why we call it the Panhandle, I suppose, is because it resolves what direction you look at it from. But those societies, however they're described geographically, certainly do not fit this kind of model. And if one says, well, it's the hunting and trapping, it's the real migratory hunter communities which have turned into the anti-growth groups, that is indeed not true. In fact, the early history of white contact in Western Canada is all involved with the fur trade, in which the native economies move very rapidly into a production for external sale. so that the classifying European society growth and the indigenous societies of North America as being subsistence in the sense of not being growth societies, I think is simply inaccurate. We do, however, have a very pervasive image in North America and some other parts of the world at the present time that native groups are anti-development. And I think to understand that, given that it is not part of the historic culture of indigenous populations, one has to understand the nature of development in peripheral areas. The only areas that we are dealing with now in which there's substantial native populations are peripheral areas in terms of the European economies which have been established in North America. And therefore, these are very dependent upon the booms and busts and factors from outside. They also have, in terms of the of locally based economies, typically a sort of limited range. You relied on the front page of my newspaper. I'll rely on, I think it's about page 8, which is talking about the trapping economy in Ray in the Northwest Territories, in which they're talking about the dependency of the community on this, that in terms of the range of activities which is possible, this, which is indeed, I think even in your terms, a growth activity, it is land-based production for external sale, is something that the community is fighting to sustain, because it is in fact the only kind of growth industry which is currently possible for that community to develop. That the image of resistance has been resistance to outside development, which has in many instances destabilized local economies, and because of its temporary nature has led to a not even being able to go back to the economies which predated the boom, and therefore in the end impoverishing communities and not strengthening them.
Andrew. We were able to try to get some information. We didn't have time, unfortunately, to travel to the Atlantic coast. But when speaking to the government, they stated that basically they realized that mistakes were made in the past and they are prepared to take corrective measures. Now, one of the things they said they were currently willing to engage in is the recognition that Indian peoples have special rights over and above that of the ordinary Nicaraguan citizen, particularly with respect to land rights and to some form of autonomy. The only thing remaining, I guess, was to determine what that meant, what self-government meant, and with the reservation or the expressed fear that they realize that the Indians do have to have a land base, as they are stating, but they have great fears that this may eventually lead to separation. But realizing that fear, they state that nevertheless they're prepared to embark in that direction. It sounded very good. At the meeting in Bogota, things did not move very quickly. The government, basically in the negotiations, which we didn't, we were there as observers, but not in the same room. So I think basically we weren't observers as such, but more, I suppose, guarantors. If and when an agreement was reached, it would have been explained to us in our presence. So that way we could have observed, I guess, the conclusion and have been witnesses to any agreement. So if there was a future breach, other people beside the Miskito delegation and the government would have had knowledge of it or been privy to the agreement. The government, according to the information we received from Brooklyn Review and the other, I think, three Mosquito negotiators, had difficulty in even accepting the notion or the term indigenous peoples or Indian peoples. It was reflected in one of the documents in response to a very well written out accord proposed by Masuda Sata for the peace process and for future negotiations. In response tabled a document which appeared to be put together very quickly in response to, you know, I guess something that they thought wouldn't take place, having the Mosquito delegation be very well prepared in what they wanted. But that response spoke in terms of ethnic groups. Okay, they couldn't bring themselves to say indigenous people or Indian peoples, but were using the term ethnic groups. And on the second day, Mr. Rivera decided that if anything, at least he would come out of this conference or this negotiations with the government recognizing them as indigenous peoples, although he was advised that don't worry about what they call you, just get your rights, then you work on, you know, on who you are. But his statement was, well, if they don't even accept us or recognize us as Indian peoples, how can we expect them to agree to Indian rights? So in the end, in the final analysis, there was a communique which set out another meeting date and thanked the observers that were there, the representatives of six countries and the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, and did refer to the Mosquito as basically indigenous. So that, in a sense, was a slight victory. The accord that was tabled was very comprehensive. It set out the aspirations of the Mosquito people as represented by Masuda Sata, and was to have been one accord of hopefully several accords that would, in the end analysis, lead to a treaty between the Mosquito Indians and the Sandinista government. And again, Masuda Sata made it clear that their objective is not to overthrow the government, but to win their rights within the current sovereignty of the Sandinista government or of the government of Nicaragua, but with a clear recognition of land rights and a form of autonomy which they were proposing in the accord. They were also talking in terms of that treaty eventually getting recognition and the protection of the proposed new constitution of the government of Nicaragua. So in a sense, not only was it peace talks, which would end up in a treaty, but also would become protected by the constitution. So in a sense, it was also also the start of a process of constitutional negotiation between the Mosquito Indians and the government of Nicaragua. I had an opportunity to speak to Mr. Carillon again on the second day, and his statement at that time was,
to define the solutions that occur when these conflicts and when these values seem so at odds, that the persistent evidence, however, and the most visible perhaps for us is in our public education system. According to a needs assessment conducted by my Aluliki agency and is now also being reassessed by OHA in a new need and an upgrading of the needs assessment, Hawaiians place education as their priority. And I will discuss that in more detail later. Mr. Professor Hank's comments on de las Casas was very new to me. It was new information. And I appreciated your comments on the accommodation, on the realistic kinds of things that we have to do in 1985 and the future in order to perhaps protect our own unique identities and our own special ways of dealing with life. Native Hawaiians face challenges that unless met with a sense of learning bicultural ways will diminish our own ability to malama, what we say malama, or take care of our own resources. The excellence of the legacy that I learned about, the Native Hawaiians' contributions in terms of navigational skills and their cosmology, made me realize that I think once our children know that heritage, they should be willing to fly spaceships. They should be willing to man them. They should be willing to go into new areas of a man's creativity with confidence, because they can bring that sense of values and attitudes that Mrs. Ward was worried about and combine them in a pluralistic society so that it can become an even more enhanced and rich life. That's my own personal view about the values that we need to maintain and keep. Moani talked earlier about some of our resources that were diminishing. We have let me tell you a little bit about our aristocracy. The last queen, after her overthrow, gathered what she had left in terms of personal property and left that to be invested so that revenues would put aside for to benefit the indigent and orphaned poor children. Today we have the Queen in the Oʻokalani Children's Center. King Lunalilo, when he died, left all of his property for the establishment and endowment of a retirement home for the aged, the elderly, the kupuna, from where we draw, like many of you do, your source of your lore, the source of your culture. The princess, the last princess in the Kamehameha dynasty, left all of her lands, the revenues of which were to establish a school for Hawaiian children. Those lands comprise about 8% of the total state lands, and a small percentage of it is invested in lease residential properties. The idea of leased property does not appeal, of course, to so many people, at least to the American dream of owning a home. And recently, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed a Hawaii state law that forces the estate to, by the use of the powers of eminent domain, to transfer title from one private owner, which is the estate, to another private owner, which is the lessee. And that has caused a great deal of turmoil, continues to cause a great deal of turmoil, because it means millions of dollars of loss in revenues that endow the schools for Hawaiian children. And that school, in the last 10 years, has changed its focus and has made every attempt to address the needs of Native Hawaiian children, not only in their own school, but in the public school system. They endowed recently, in the last 8 years, early education research program that looks at how Native Hawaiian children learn. Why are they so different? Do they learn differently from other children that are non-native? And they have begun to make some tremendous strides in developing educational methodology and techniques in dealing with the educational success for Native Hawaiians. And Oahu has been a part of that effort with them. Despite the tragedies, and we can sit here and breastfeed about our tragedies, or we can look at our present situation as challenges. We are today a recognized minority. We are part of, just as you are, we are all Native Americans. Our people have intermarried. Our spirit of aloha in our state continues to be recognized for its universal and mutually benefiting means. My personal belief, as I said before, is our children, having learned the magnificence and excellence of our own culture, will be able to grow up learning about those superb accomplishments that their ancestors made, and our ancestors also have a deeply spiritual regard and appreciation for our islands and our culture. Once our children learn that root, once they I think really acquire that and learn that, learn what their ethos and intrinsic worth is, I know that it will empower them to face this, the future that we all, must all face, and they're going to succeed.
Thank you, Guy. Thanks very much. Thank you all. I was going to, yes, Rosita.
I just wanted to thank you for coming.
From notions that are thought of. When we talk about homes connected with getting a mortgage, we have rolled over automatically. When we accepted models of governance that have nothing to do with the way we govern, we've rolled over once again. So I think these are very important issues that have circulated throughout these discussions, and we've got to be very clear about what those things mean. And our dear relatives from Hawaii have really brought these things out this morning, and we'll continue to talk about them, I know, but I just want to point to that. When Professor Hanke brought up the institutions in Hawaii which purport to serve the interest of Native Hawaiians, like a museum, for example, we have to know that museum as we know it in the world, and I do represent one of the biggest. I represent museum, like airport. No. Wait, I say purport.
I thought you were quoting me.
No. I'm simply pointing out to you that when we talk about museum or professors of Hawaiian history, they are never us. They are not run by us. They are concepts that have never been converted to our notions. So they memorialize species they think they have killed. You know, they are monuments to death. No. Let's have no illusions about who teaches our
Native Hawaiian Educational Assessment report that has a very definitive study on Hawaiian student achievement throughout the state of Hawaii. And that's it took a while, but it was done. Getting back to Mr. Hanke, I wanted to also tell you that the OHA Cultural Education Committee has just approved the formation of a Council of Kupuna, or Council of Elders, to serve as the last word in matters of language and culture. And that pleases us, because that is the source of our culture, and that we recognize that, and we've begun to make that move. One more thing about Hawaiian homelands, which seems to be the devil here. The governors in the past administrations have taken by executive order lands from the resources that the Department of Hawaiian Homelands has. And the present governor has just returned most all of them except one section. So there is progress being made.
Thank you, Guard. We'll come back later and hear from Bishop Daru, and perhaps sometime tomorrow, at an appropriate time, we might return to the subject that Bernie Nietzschman and Doug and Shelton Davis raised regarding international law and the place of, and the recognition of indigenous peoples as more than merely, if I may use that word, ethnic minorities. And that, I think, is an appropriate subject for consideration under the title, The Place of Native People in the Western World. Well, look, let's come back at 2 o'clock sharp. 2 o'clock.
sense in the interpretation of that. That's not very clear. But what seems to be going on in that international covenant is the recognition of people as ethnic groups, but not as indigenous people. In international law. In that sense, you have the right to maintain your culture again, but not to have any political rights that go along with it. And it seems to me that one of the great contributions here is to go beyond that issue of linking up the cultural rights with the political rights. I think that that's where the challenge is now to show that. And if we do it, we're going to have to really change a lot of national law and national thinking and international law if we do it.
Good point, Sandy. Well, Gard, we promised you the last word.
I should be real quick.
Take your time.
Mrs. Worrell, that in your definition of civilized and uncivilized, I was raised by kupuna or elders, and all I can remember, in Hawaiians you learn by intuition. There isn't so much as direct instruction. You had to be a real keen observer. You had to listen very carefully, and had to. That's how you learn. That's how you grew up. Anyway, what I used to hear was that haoles were people. Ha means breath in Hawaiian. Breath meaning life, and haoles were people. Aole means no people who didn't have breath or life. So. You know, it works two ways, when civilized and uncivilized. We always call them haole, people without life, without breath. It was an interesting discrimination, reverse as it might be. On the education woman there that was talking about education, about 12 years ago, the Kamehameha Schools Bishop of State realized that Hawaiian children were failing, and for 7 years had to lobby the State Department of Education to allow them to conduct a needs assessment on Hawaiian student achievement. 7 years it took of constantly knocking on the door with the State Department of Education, but the answer is that the Hawaiians themselves had to do it. Now, as a result of that, when they finally got into the Department of Education, then we went to the federal government to set up a National Education Commission on Hawaiian education, and that was also Carter appointed people, then he went out of office and Reagan dismantled it. So what we did was go to the state, the federal Department of Education, and the Bishop of State agreed to pay for the whole study if the federal people would accept it, the findings, and they did. And we now have, as a result, a Native Hawaiian Educational Assessment report that has a very definitive study on Hawaiian student achievement throughout the state of Hawaii. And that's, it took a while, but it was done. Getting back to Mr. Hanke, I wanted to also tell you that the OHA Cultural Education Committee has just approved the formation of a Council of Kupuna, or Council of Elders, to serve as the last word in matters of language and culture. And that pleases us, because that is the source of our culture, and that we recognize that, and we've begun to make that move. One more thing about Hawaiian homelands, which seems to be the devil here. The governors in the past administrations have taken by executive order lands from the resources the Department of Hawaiian Homelands has. And the present governor has just returned most all of them except one section. So there is progress being made.
Thank you, Gard. We'll come back later and hear from Bishop Daru, and perhaps sometime tomorrow at an appropriate time we might return to the subject that Bernie Nietzschman and Doug and Shelton Davis raised regarding international law and the place of and the recognition of indigenous peoples as more than merely, if I may use that word, ethnic minorities. And that, I think, is an appropriate subject for consideration under the title The Place of Native People in the Western World. Well, look, let's come back at 2 o'clock sharp. 2 o'clock.
Catholic Bishop of Victoria and a well-known figure in Canada and an outspoken defender of native rights in Canada and throughout the hemisphere. And Bishop Drew also chaired the committee of Canadian bishops that 2 years ago published a document called Ethical Reflections on the Economy that has stirred 2 years of heaven forbid controversy in Canada, and which may have had something to do with the document published recently by the Catholic bishops in the United States. Bishop Drew also attended Vatican II. He is one of Canada's leading clerical figures, if that's an appropriate way to put it. So, Bishop Drew, would you carry on, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I once heard a speaker, after a similar presentation, say, "I didn't know I was that famous, and now I'm anxious to hear myself." I do appreciate your kind remarks. I'd like first to just point to the title and subtitle of my paper and indicate that I see it as only initial reflections, a modest contribution to a panel, not definitive or complete answers. And without spending time on the paper as such, I'd like to come back to what I think are a couple of initial questions. First, I want to thank Sheldon Kutztag for making sure everybody has read the paper. And then I want to come at his question, which is a very valid one that he has now raised twice, and I've heard others raise on many occasions. Why are Christians not Christians? Why don't they apply the ideals that the native peoples equally believe in? And there's a deeper question behind that. What's religion got to do with this in the first place? Has religion got anything to do with native rights and colonialism? And shouldn't religion just back off and stay out of a field that's not theirs? So I'm just going to offer my personal suggestions, and they're going to hinge around that expression I used, perspectives of a liberating faith. And I want to spend a bit of time on what I perceive as a liberating faith. And in so doing, I will try to explain why I'm here in the first place and why I'm saying the things that I'm saying, and why I feel that in doing that, I am doing theology in the strictest sense of the word. When I say that I'm doing theology, I am sharing with, I think, most human beings in searching for meaning. I too want to find a meaning for my life. I want to find those values that can give direction to my life and that can structure it. It is those values who tell us who we are and what our purpose in life is. And in this sense, I think it's not unfair to say that all peoples are basically religious in that deeper and broader sense, and that we all share these religious aspirations. So I start from the premise that I believe there are such things as lasting values, major values, transcendent values, if you will, that tell us that we have a past, that we have traditions which have made us what we are. We have a meaning beyond simple physical survival or physical satisfaction. And we have a future. In other words, I believe there is a life beyond, and that I can establish relationships with all of you and all the other human beings who will cross my path, that are not just relationships for today or tomorrow, but that are lasting relationships. And in that sense, every time we meet, we have affected our mutual lives eternally. That is my feeling. Because when I say there are lasting or transcendent values, I believe that I have relationships with a higher being, call that being God or some supreme power or whatever name you wish, and that these relationships are nothing less than a call to share in a life that is more than human, that I will call divine. And with all respect to all the other religions that have their own vocabulary and their own perceptions and their own language, my personal faith tells me that this supreme being, whom I call God, has not only revealed himself or herself, I won't get into that controversy at this point, in Christ, but that by accepting the revelation of God in Christ, I learn who I am as a human being, that I'm really more than just merely human. My whole tradition, the biblical background out of which I come, and the experience of 2,000 years of Christianity based on the previous experience of thousands of years of my Jewish sisters and brothers, revealed to me that there are divine values that I share with others.
Years, and all of a sudden the state gives the go-ahead to go ahead and dredge and even redirect the river. And that is going to affect a lot of our salmon spawning. It's going to affect the animal life within that region. And this is why it becomes so important. I don't want really the eco side, see, I got to use that sparingly, like you said. Ecocide. When I start to look at the CNN news and I look at 60 Minutes and I read about the pollution, even in the underground water, fast becoming a non-renewable resource, and I take a look at the malformed salmon fry, and once in a while I begin to think that maybe Birds Incorporated is trying to give up a glowing duck so it can have 24-hour hunting, but so what I'm trying to say is that I think we have to eventually have to have our own form of self-government, because it's only then that we will be able to make real progress in self-determination and also trying to replenish or replace especially the non-renewable resources. There's a great demand on them, and they're fast being depleted, and here we are battling all the time, and that's part of the politics. Keep us in conflict, and that way domination. We are dominated, and the only time that we'll really be able to make progress is when we are no longer off balance because of the court battles, all the laws that we have to try to change, et cetera, that are always keeping us off balance. But I think the tribal government would be a good way of beginning this. And the, I guess, between those two, the Western civilization with their dominion, their control, their manipulation of nature, and our way of life, wanting to live in peace and harmony with nature.
you, Oscar. Robert Goldwyn, and then Bishop Giroux, and then Dennis Stemmert.
Yes, well, I really only want to ask Bishop Giroux a question about his paper, and in fact the same passages that Shelton read aloud. These four are consequences of what you call the techno-industrial view of creation. But in the paper, you are very stingy in telling us what that view is, and so I thought it would be helpful to everyone if you would enlarge on it a bit. You say the industrial vision was initially rooted in a Judeo-Christian view of creation, but took on a more rational scientific orientation during the Enlightenment, and then that's all you say about it. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the simplest way to say what the Judeo-Christian view of creation was is that it is a creation of everything out of nothing. But just what this more rational scientific orientation during the Enlightenment was, and why if you would explain that, then it would be clearer why all these consequences flow from that distortion.
The two questions that have just been raised are really closely related one with the other. First of all, Oscar's question about taking dominion in Genesis. I'm not a Bible scholar, and I'll stand correction from...
I think is probably a necessary condition. And so I think that this development, including things like the Alaska Native Review Commission, we are participating at this very time, in a way are taken collectively among the most hopeful signs of generating the consciousness and energy to break out of the cycle that I think we're seeing anywhere in the world.
Yeah, thank you, Art. Rosita.
Can I just add on? Carried a little bit further. Can we begin to talk about a decolonization process of this internal colonialism? And can we talk about a liberation of the colonizer? I just add that on to the thought.
Well, Oren's reflections are, I think, apposite, that is simply changing legal forms and institutional arrangements may by itself not affect what happens on the ground an awful lot. But Mr. Henry Hsu, yes, sir, sorry.
Especially since we won't have Bishop Giroux with us tomorrow, I'd like to try to draw him out a little more about how he sees the role of the church in dealing with colonial situations. I thought I heard a very sharp and clear message in what you said, and I'd like to really ask you a very simple question, which I'm sure leaves out some of the subtleties, but it's really just a way to invite you to say which subtleties you want to put back in. I see to me that you argued very strongly that it's the business of the church to show a preference for the poor, to really take the side of the victims, and the rich and the powerful also have souls, I speak as an outsider, by the way, but as I understand it, the church also has a ministry to the oppressors, and so in whatever way it takes the side of the oppressed, it mustn't violate it, whatever its ministry is to the oppressors. But nevertheless, with that sort of constraint, I take it you're really saying the church should be taking the side of the victims of the oppression. And I would think that in Alaska, that would mean taking the side of the natives. And I would like to
see if I misheard you and see what qualifications you might want to put on that.
No, you didn't. You didn't misread me, or you heard correctly what I was saying. I would just like to recall that I did say also that poverty must not be limited just to the economic spheres. There's an even deeper poverty at the social and cultural, including religious, dimensions. And ultimately, if you look back to the New Testament, one of the harshest judgments that Jesus repeatedly makes is the judgment on the rich. And he says it will be almost impossible for the rich to enter into the kingdom of God. And the reason for that is that he's really speaking here of spiritual poverty, because the rich already have their reward. In other words, they are not aware that they need salvation. So because they don't